basic idea would be that MMT is trying to build a better mousetrap. I think that's the way to think about it. So right now, what we do is we have the Federal Reserve trying to fight inflation by creating unemployment. That's how the Fed fights inflation. And what MMT would do is actually use full employment.
The Fed is probably potentially the biggest risk factor, although I don't think that they're likely to do anything stupid.
The fourth quarter was dragged down slightly by the government shutdown. I think we still had very healthy numbers year over year. If you look at fourth quarter to fourth quarter, it was over 3%. Otherwise, it was slightly under 3%. But we've been talking about sustained 3% economic growth, and the outlook in the United States still looks very strong.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, we had a historic summit in Hanoi, unfortunately, no deal, and modern monetary theory is borrow and print as much as you can as long as it's in your own currency. And of course, nobody's expecting a recession this year. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. It was sort of a mixed week on Wall Street, and we'll be talking about that with our technician this week, Tom McClellan. He's still bullish. He says stocks are going higher, and it's always positive in the third year of a presidential election cycle. Later on in the program, we'll have another edition of Smart Macro with Chris Poplava as we look at global LAIs, the investment implications. And what if interest rates, at least on treasuries, turn out different if the Fed goes on pause and stops QT? All of that plus Ryan Poplava, what moved the markets this week, coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in Hour 2, the big picture, Jim and I discuss what's happening with key commodities such as oil and precious metals. And also, we'll talk about the possible crisis in the corporate debt markets. We've done several shows on this subject, but it's now starting to gain wider attention. In fact, just this last week, the OECD issued an extensive report that we'll talk about coming up in the big picture. And now let's welcome back Ryan Poplava to give us this week's wrap-up report.
Well, Chris, we're going to talk about three key factors this week. It's the Fed, trade, and economics. But when you get down to it, this market is powered more by the thoughts on the Fed's patience than anything else, because we saw those two things. We saw the Fed and trade go head-to-head on Wednesday, and the Fed came out on top. Now, on that note, Fed Chairman Jay Powell testified before both houses of Congress to discuss the economy and Fed policy, and he didn't add anything new to the conversation on patience and a steady economy. But on Wednesday, he said that the Fed is close to agreeing on a plan to end the balance sheet runoff, and immediately we saw a surge in stocks. Now, that has additional color since the January policy statement suggested they had begun discussing it. So talking about here that they're close to an agreement, that was something new and fresh. And an end to QT, quantitative tightening, and that just helped the rally in the S&P 500 back up to its highs this week, right around 2800, where we've been kind of floundering and trying to look for the next catalyst to either take us higher or maybe take us into a bit of profit taking. There have been some fears leading up to his testimony that he would drop some hawkish comments, kind of given the markets come back very strongly, but that didn't happen. So, okay, let's talk trade. Part of the rally over the past 2 months after the oversold conditions kind of waned were not only related to the Fed's patience, but also on both China and the U.S. coming to the trade table before the March deadline. You know, could we see real agreement between the two countries, or would we see tariffs be raised up from 10% to 25% on the $200 billion worth of Chinese goods that is already currently in effect? Now, Trump tweeted moments before the futures market opened over the weekend that productive talks, I will be delaying the U.S. increase in tariffs now scheduled for March 1st, assuming both sides make progress, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I had a few more things to say there, but the key point was there. He was ready, he said, possibly to delay the increase in tariffs. Now, that immediately sent the Shanghai surging about 6% higher and set our markets on solid footing Monday morning. Now, Wednesday this week, as I said, the Fed and trade went head-to-head in the headlines there. Trade Representative Lighthizer testified to Congress that it is too early to predict the outcome, that more exports to China are not enough, and that any agreement must be enforceable. So that kind of triggered a little bit of uncertainty on whether the trades would get through. And obviously, we've had headlines this all throughout the last couple of months. So kind of good cop Trump on Sunday and bad cop Lighthizer setting down expectations. Now, this pulled the market back Wednesday initially, but like I said, Powell helped rally it. And finally, to end the week on trade, Bloomberg reported that a working document was being drafted for Trump and President Xi to sign as early as possibly mid-March, and that helped the stock market end on a high note for the week. Now, let's move on to the third thing I want to talk about, the economic side of things. Investors want to see that things are improving with the stock market recovering 20% off the December lows. So, is there some substance to this rally? And if not, is there enough there to cause us to reconsider this rally and this outcome so far on the Fed being patient? Let's talk housing. Housing starts were down 11.2% in December, and coupled with lower guidance from Home Depot in the week when they gave their earnings, who had said that they see their 2019 outlook lower, it kind of left a concern that housing isn't stabilizing. But more current data, like the mortgage application composite, is showing a pickup and really has bullishly inflected given rates have dropped. Now, pending home sales surged in January. Again, more recent information here, up 4.6%, reversing a string of losses, with the South and the Midwest registering the largest gains. Now, let's talk about the consumer confidence, which, if you recall, Chris, at the last reading, Jeffrey Gundlach called the gap between present conditions and expectations, which were very wide, the most recessionary signal yet. Those were his words. And that gap has since closed. Since now in February, we saw a big rebound in the consumer confidence from 121.7 up to 131.4. And there was a very big pickup in that expectations index component, which was really low back in January. And that's helped instilling some confidence that the consumer's attitude is there and is positive, and that will lead towards, obviously, hopefully, continued sales growth in consumption. Now, we ended the week on two interesting notes. The preliminary GDP figure for Q4 showed real GDP grew 2.6%, which was above consensus, but still down from Q3. But the idea is, again, it was above what the market was expecting, and it led to some confidence there. And we also got a drop in the ISM manufacturing data for February. It was down to 54.2 from 56.6. And that was lower than the consensus was estimating. But it didn't really seem to phase the market on Friday as investors continued to buy all the way back up to, again, that 2,800 figure on the S&P 500. That was probably helped by that Bloomberg article I mentioned that a trade agreement is in the works, probably because, you know, a reading of 54, if we take a real serious look at that ISM manufacturing data, 54 is still expansionary. And, you know, it's not communicating yet that there is a substantial weakening in the economy yet.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
We have to understand that the Fed stopped hiking rates not because they achieved their objective of, you know, a 3% nominal rate or a 1% real rate. They stopped because they got freaked out by what happened in the fourth quarter in the markets, and they see a dramatic economic slowing going on overseas. So there's a big difference. So we have to ask ourselves, why did they stop? Do we really want them to stop at 2.25, 2.5? Can the U.S. economy not handle a Fed funds rate really north of that? I think that's kind of scary, actually. And we have to ask ourselves, well, if what happens if we do end up slowing down? Does the Fed really have any bullets to deal with it? Does the European Central Bank, that still has negative interest rates, are they going to go into the next recession there without having anything to do? They'll try to do something, but it's certainly not going to matter. And that we'll all end up being like Japan. I'd rather have the economy accelerating and the Fed continuing to raise than them stopping at 2.25, 2.5, because there's a problem out there that they see.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, it's been a pretty good year for stock investors, even bond investors and commodities, just like the last couple of months of last year when stocks, bonds, and commodities went down. Well, we have the opposite effect this year. They're all going up. Will that last? We'll find out here. Joining me on the program is Tom McClellan. And Tom, let's talk about a couple of things. You sent me a couple of charts. The first one is the New York Stock Exchange Advanced Decline Line. Tell me what that chart is telling you.
Hi, Jim. It's good to be with you. The Advanced Decline Line is a really simple indicator. It looks every day at how many stocks went up that day versus went down. The difference between advances and declines is known as daily breadth. And so then to get the advanced decline line, you just sum all of the prior daily breadth readings. So the advanced decline line will move up or down every day by the daily breadth number. When you have predominantly positive breadth for a long time, then the advanced decline line moves up in important ways. And it's already up to a new all-time high, whereas the Dow and the S&P and the other major averages are not. What that's saying is that the breadth numbers are better than what the price indices are saying. That's a very, very bullish condition.
That's telling you that this rally has legs to it, would it not?
Exactly right. And there's other ways you can look at it other than just the raw advanced decline line. You can measure the slope of it. You can use exponential moving averages and all sorts of ways to slice and dice it to see precisely how strong it is. But the basic message is that gobs of breath is very bullish. And the fact that we've seen it coming out of the Christmas Eve low says there's a bunch of money that's banging on the door of the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ and all the exchanges trying to get in. And it can't all fit in through the door at the same time. When you see really strong breadth numbers like we have seen, and you get a Zweig breadth thrust indicator, and you get high McClellan oscillator readings, and all sorts of other breadth momentum continuation signals, it says there's lots of money and it's going to continue flowing for a while. At the point when we get to where we're seeing higher price size on the S&P 500 and a lower advanced decline line high, then it'll be time to really worry. We're a long way from that based on the strength of the numbers we're seeing, and it's likely to continue for a long time. And it should continue because we're in the third year of a presidential term, which is nearly always an up year. So you should expect a bull market to happen. And what the advanced decline line is saying is we're getting confirmation that, yes, indeed, it is a bull market.
When you have the vast majority of stocks going up like this, but let me ask you, Tom, was it looking like this last year as we headed into the fall where we were hitting one record after another leading into October, and then all of a sudden it fell apart?
Good question. Different indices topped at different times in the late third quarter, early fourth quarter. Some of the indices topped in late September, some topped October 3rd, but there was a rounding top process. The advanced decline line topped before the price indices topped, and it was showing us a divergence as of the beginning of October of 2018. Prior to that divergence, though, it had been strong for the first three quarters of 2018. Strong even with all the January, February excitement at the beginning of the year. The advanced decline line was saying that despite all that volatility we saw in the beginning of 2018, there really wasn't a liquidity problem. It only said, hey, there's a liquidity problem once we got to that final October 2018 high, and the advanced decline line showed a divergence, and sure enough, we saw an ugly sell-off. Now it's saying gobs of strength, gobs of liquidity, and the reason this works is that when you see the majority of stocks going up, it says that there's a whole lot of money that wants to go to work. You can keep the major averages going up with a little bit of liquidity if it's channeled into the right stocks. But usually what happens is the rest of the list suffers. And so you see things like underperformance of small caps, because there are more small caps than large caps. And you see underperformance of the advanced decline line. We're not seeing that now. We're seeing gobs of strength, which says there's so much money around going around that it has to flow into every possible pocket and lift the majority of stocks. And that's a condition that tends to last for a while.
When you see stocks like this, I guess what looks a little different, last year you had a lot of domination by the FANG stocks. I mean, goodness, you had companies like Amazon and Apple at one time worth over $1 trillion. It seems to me, as you take a look at the various S&P sectors, things like industrials are doing well. It's almost across the board with REITs and utilities actually breaking out to new highs.
And utilities breaking out ahead of industrials is a positive sign. When the two of those disagree, it's usually the utilities that's correct about where both are headed. People think that the transportation average fulfills that role, and it doesn't really do that good of a job compared to the utility stocks. So, yeah, it's across the board. And the tough thing to do in an environment like this is to sit on your hands and resist the urge to click the mouse and trade something. It's riding a trend is where most of the money is made. And so this is a strong uptrend.
Now, you sent me another chart. It's a log scale of crude oil set forward 10 years. What is that chart telling you about oil?
Well, it's not telling us about oil. It's telling us about the stock market. And I hope that you can share that with your viewers and your listeners. I have studied lots of different markets. And when studying the crude oil market with all the data that I could find, which goes back to 1890, I saw that there was a familiar pattern. It looked just like the pattern of the advances and the pauses and the advances in the bear markets and the stock market. So I put them both on a chart together and it looked almost right. But I found that if I slid the price of crude oil plot forward by 10 years, then the Dow Jones Industrial Average echoed those same movements. So when the price of crude oil goes up, then 10 years later, the price of the Dow goes up. And you get bear markets in stock market 10 years after you get a bear market in oil prices. And this has been going on for the entirety of the history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which started in 1896. But it's been working all of that time. Now, it doesn't work perfectly. Sometimes it's not exactly 10 years. Sometimes it's 9.5 years. Sometimes it's 10.5 years. It's not exactly perfect, but it's just really, really good. I talked about the confirmation that we are seeing a bull market now. What this indicator is saying is we're supposed to be seeing a bull market right now, because coming out of the 2009 bear market bottom, crude oil prices got beaten down along with stocks. They bought up the crude oil bottomed in January 2009 and went up nicely all through 2009 and 10 and 11. We should expect the echo of that to appear in the stock market in 2019, 20, and 21. And so we're in a bull market. We have confirmation from the AD line that we are in a bull market, and it's a strong one. And we have confirmation from this predictive indicator that we're supposed to be in one. It's nice when the predictive indicators and the confirming indicators all agree about what's happening. We have a lot more struggling and head scratching when there's disagreement between them, but that's not a problem we face right now.
So from your perspective, as you look at all your indicators, everything is supportive of this rally. Would it surprise you if, well, let's take last year as a good example, what happened in the first week of February and what happened after October? Because, Tom, you know, we look at it from the fundamental side. If you would have looked at a $1.5 trillion stimulus bill, if you look at an additional $300 billion of spending, a cut in corporate tax rates with corporate profits coming in at 25% a quarter, I don't think anybody January of 2018 would have saw what happened in the final weeks of 2018. So if there's anything, is there anything out there that would surprise you or could catch you off guard?
Well, you know, you got two nuclear armed countries, Pakistan and India, that are exchanging gunfire from fighter planes and shooting each other down. That's not a good thing generally. And so a global geopolitical event risk like that is possible at any time. I hope that we don't get into anything silly like that, and that the normal third year strength of the stock market can play itself out. There's going to be some noise that'll come along every once in a while. So just some counter trend movement, which is healthy to keep the wall of worry going. We're in a tiny little pause like that, a little 2 week soft spot on the seasonality calendar in late February to early March. And so the market's going sideways as opposed to a linear uptrend. That's normal. If that stops happening, it'll be a problem. So for the longer term investor, this is the time to ride the uptrend and enjoy it and focus on the grandchildren. We can worry about the next ugly bear market due to come around 2024, which will be the 10-year echo of the big down move that we saw in oil prices in 2014.
So looking at this, it's telling you this is a strong bull market trend. I want to talk about another factor that could maybe change this. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve. They started getting very hawkish sounding in September. They went to 4 hikes instead of 3, sounded even more hawkish when it came to the end of the year. And then all of a sudden, we got the correction. Commodities, oil fell 40%. Bonds got hammered. Stocks got hammered. And all of a sudden, Tom, they're, you know, singing like canaries from the same hymn book that, hey, we're on pause and the markets take off. Could they alter this? In other words, let's say oil prices pick up, inflation starts to heat up, and all of a sudden they're talking hawkish again.
Well, the Fed accidentally arrived at exactly the right interest rate policy, not because of being smart, but just because of, I don't know, following their own mood. What we like to watch is the 2-year Treasury note yield, and where that is relative to the Fed funds rate should tell the Fed what they ought to do. I haven't convinced anybody at the Federal Reserve to take my advice and just outsource interest rate policy to the 2-year note yield, even though we'd get a much better outcome if you did, because you'd have less overstimulation when it was a wrong idea. You'd have overly restrictive interest rate policy like we had in 2007 and 2008 if you get the Fed funds rate to adjust as quickly as the 2-year note yield does. Right now, the two of them are within about a quarter to a half a point, which is about as close as they ever get, and that's a good thing. The Fed ought to stick right here and wait until the 2-year note yield moves somewhere to tell them what to do, and then it ought to move promptly once they see that happen. But those guys all have expensive PhDs, and so they think they know better than the bond market. So I'm not likely to convince them of the wisdom of following a very simple indicator, the 2-year note yield, to get guidance of what they should do. But for the moment, they're in a great place. They're not being overly restrictive or overly stimulative, and that's a good thing.
All right, let's move on to a couple other sectors. Let's look at interest rates. We hit, as we were coming out of October, we hit 3.25 on the 10-year note. We're now well below it by almost a half a point. What's your take on interest rates here?
We look at long-term Treasury bonds mostly, and what we find is that the yield on long-term Treasury bonds follows the movements of crude oil with not a 10-year lag time, but with about a 3-week lag time. And so because we've seen crude oil prices trending upward since the December 24th low with stocks, that upward trend says that bond yields should be trending upward also. Bonds have been pausing a little bit. They haven't kept up with what crude oil's message says should have happened. And in my view, what that means is that bonds have wandered off track and they're going to have to work hard to make up for lost time. So that means bond prices going down, bond yields going up at a faster rate than what oil says, just because they've got some catching up to do. There's one other factor I'll tell you about, Jim. Every quarter, you have a roll in the futures market, in the bond futures market, from one contract to the next. So right now, we're in the middle of the roll from the March contract to the June contract in T-bonds. And when you have that roll going on, you get a climax peak in total open interest among all of the bond contracts that usually happens on about the 27th day of the month before expiration, so ideally February 27th. We already had that peak in open interest a couple days ago. For about a week to 2 weeks after that peak in open interest, you generally see a decline in bond prices, a rising yield. And we're seeing that right now, happening right on schedule. It doesn't work every time. If you get an oversold condition at the moment of the roll, then it doesn't tend to work. But if you're in an uptrend and that roll arrives on the calendar, then you usually get a 1 to 2 week drop in T-bond prices. So I think that's what we're seeing right now. And at some point, bonds will be an opportunity for a trading buy again, but we're not at that point today.
Tom, you mentioned the price of oil, and it kind of linked to the future price of the Dow. Let's talk about oil and commodities, specifically three that I have in mind. One would be oil and copper, because that tells you a lot about economic growth, and then also the price of gold, which many times tells you about the safety or fair trade.
Okay, which one do you want to start with?
Well, you take your pick. Why don't we begin with oil, because you sent that chart with the link to the future of the Dow.
Right, and in that case, we're using oil as the messenger. We're not prejudging what the messenger is going to do with itself. We're using what it has done as the harbinger of what stock prices are going to do. And I love getting the answers ahead of time. I do expect oil prices to continue to rise. Oil tends to follow gold with about a 20-month lag time, but it's a really sloppy correlation, so you can't just write it down and follow the calendar based on what gold says, as well as you can in some other leading indications. But that leading indication from gold says that we should expect oil prices to continue rising near term. What they do longer term depends on whether we end sanctions on Iran and how much electric cars versus gasoline cars are going into India and a bunch of things that are way too hard to model altogether. Copper is not saying all that much at all. It's just chopping sideways. We like to get insights about where copper is going by looking at the commitment of traders data that's published by the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And right now, the latest data that they've put out show really a neutral condition. The commercials are not skewing either to the long side or the short side. And one problem there is that the government shutdown for over a month led the CFTC to stop publishing those. And so now they're trying to get caught up by publishing two of them every week and going through the backlog of all the data. So we're still a couple of weeks behind on even what the message is from the futures market. So I really don't have any insights on what copper might be saying for the general health of the economy. And that whole idea of copper, Dr. Copper being the commodity with a PhD in economics, that kind of fell into trouble when China started using copper bullion as collateral for loans. And so copper had a new usage other than being wound into wiring for motors and houses in a way that it hadn't had before. And that really threw a rock in the pond and created some waves in terms of how copper prices behave in ways that they weren't doing before and that it make it much tougher to analyze. So I wish I had better insights about that than I do, but I don't have good ones.
All right. What about gold?
Gold was supposed to make a big cycle bottom in February of 2019. It's a 13.5-month cycle. Instead, it swooped up to a top. And so what appears to have happened is that the cycle bottom, instead of being one nice sharp valley, like you'd think of the Grand Canyon hitting the bottom where the Colorado River is, it split into two bottoms, and we're going to be forming the second part of that here over the next several weeks. I look at gold heading back downward, silver even more so, because there we do see a big enough net short reading in the Commodity Futures Trading Commission that the COT data, the silver commercial traders are big time net short. And that's saying silver prices ought to go down and gold prices will go down with it. What's happening recently since about 2016 is that gold has fallen into a very, very strong correlation, not only with the Japanese yen, but also with the Chinese yuan. They used to not have a really strong relationship before the yuan got added to a basket of currencies that the world banks use for trading among themselves. Once that happened, the yuan and gold started having a very tight correlation, and both the yuan and the yen recently were not confirming the higher highs in gold prices. So I'm expecting all those to go down until we get to some equilibrium point and finish up the work of putting in this split bottom cycle that was supposed to be centered in February of 2019. Gold is going to do better later this year, but today is not the day to play that.
So as you see things right now, if I was to sum up, this is a strong bull trend. It's confirmed by your forward projections of oil, also the advanced decline line. Tom, as an investor, what would you be doing here?
Sitting on my hands and resisting the attempt to try to trade and jump in and out. This is a strong trend and you want to ride it. If you're not already invested, look for any little dip as your sign to get in and enjoy it and ride it. We're going to be headed up generally higher. Not in a straight line, but generally higher till about 2021. And actually, if that is true, like it should be, then that bodes well for President Trump getting reelected, because it's really tough to defeat an incumbent president when you're having a bull market in the stock market. So if the Democrats want to ensure their victory, they'll have to somehow have to engineer a bear market going into November of 2020 and strengthen their odds. Otherwise, if you have an uptrend, it's really, really hard to defeat an incumbent.
All right, Tom. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners like to follow the work that you do, tell them an easy way to do so.
Pay a visit to our website. It's mcoscillator.com, which is a contraction of McLellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed back in 1969, 50 years ago this year. And they can take a look at our learning center with lots of free articles. They can look at our subscriptions page for the paid subscription publications. We have a twice monthly newsletter, and we also have a daily edition. There are samples of those on that page, and you can take a look. If we can serve you, it would be our privilege. And if it's not for you, that's fine too.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
When it comes to understanding the market singularity, we actually are talking about building an all-powerful computer that takes over the market. We are. The only thing is, this is not a computer that's sitting in a lab or in a data center in Switzerland. It's understanding that this computer or network is spread across the globe, and it's becoming increasingly complex and autonomous, and we are also part of it because it feeds off our data.
Well, we've seen some recent weakness in U.S. economic indicators just coming out this week, the University of Michigan survey. We also got another lower print on ISM Manufacturing Index. And also, fourth quarter GDP came out, slowed down to only 2.6%. Well, is this going on just here in the U.S., or are we slowing down global? For that, we go to Smart Macro next with Chris Poplava. Chris, let's talk about some of the LEIs. We've seen a definite slowdown here in the U.S. The GDP numbers have come down, and now we just got another lower print on the ISM manufacturing. We'll get service next week. So what's going on globally?
Well, globally, you know, if we look at kind of the big news today that came out was the PMI in China came out, and it was better than expected, still in contraction territory, but there was a slight uptick. But there's other PMI data that's available for China that actually showed a decline. So globally, we are seeing, you know, continued softness, but the hope is that, you know, it's, you know, not necessarily, you know, the big change is that we'd see stabilization. So if you look at globally, you know, global growth really peaked late 2017. All of last year, global growth was slowing down. And so for them, they're much further along in that slowdown. So what you're looking for internationally is some stabilization, which is what you would expect to see before you see kind of a pickup in global growth. And I think we're finally starting to see that. But on the other side of the spectrum is the U.S., which really, economically speaking, didn't peak until the fall of last year. And we're continuing to slow. So we're kind of behind everyone on that slowdown period. And when you look at prior growth slowdowns, they can last anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years. And you know, if you're looking at late 17 as, you know, kind of the general starting point for that, we should expect to see a bottom in global growth sometime in the middle part of this year. So it makes sense. We are starting to see some stabilization in China, and they have done some stimulus there. But, you know, I think the thing that investors need to be careful of is jumping the gun of getting too far ahead of the actual bottom in global growth.
You know, let's talk about some of the investment implications, because we know last year, if you started out the year, we had the stimulus coming from tax, we had the additional government spending. So, Chris, if you were looking at the fundamentals last year, 25% growth in corporate earnings, GDP going up in the 4 and 3% range, you would have not expected to end up the year on the negative side, both in bonds, commodities, and stocks. What could change that picture this year, if any?
You know, I think there's really two things to really get the investment picture right is the path of the dollar, which really impacts inflation trends, it impacts exports, it impacts investments, whether you should be investing abroad or domestically, and then also global growth. Global growth is picking up. That's generally a risk-on environment. Risk assets do well. The problem that you can have is when, for example, last year we saw global growth slowing, at the same time the dollar was strengthening. That's a really bad recipe for commodities. That's a bad recipe for international investments, whether international equities or international bonds or foreign currencies. And that's what we saw. So if we kind of look at things now, I think we could see the potential for almost the reverse of that. If you look at global growth, it's really one of the things I was looking at was the 38 countries of the OECD, and the bulk of them were in contraction territory or at least slowing down. from where their highs were. And because of that, there's really almost no more lower that you can go, where I think of something like 90% of all OECD countries were showing negative economic momentum. So I would expect that we're kind of probably getting close to the end of the global growth slowdown. We should see some stabilization. If you think about it internationally, with the dollar strengthening last year, foreign currencies were down, some of them dramatically so, especially in the EM. And so that should benefit their export industries. And then if you see a weaker dollar ahead, that would benefit them in terms of their dollar funding liabilities. So, you know, a lot of companies and sovereign nations borrow in dollars. And so when the dollar is rising, that's making the cost of their dollar debt more expensive. So we might see some relief there financially, and then also economically. And then the other side of the equation would be the dollar. So, you know, last year, as I was mentioning, we had a slowing global growth and a strong dollar. I think we could see the opposite this year, where we have global growth stabilizing in the first part of the year and then maybe advancing in the second part, which would benefit risk assets, especially internationally. But if the U.S. continues to slow, and again, we're kind of late to the game. Everyone was slowing earlier than we were. And if we are going to continue to slow, that's going to put more pressure on Powell to not only not raise interest rates this year. You know, if you look at what the market is pricing in, the market's pricing in no rate hike. But if you listen to various economists, whether at Goldman Sachs or other places, some of the numbers I'm seeing are anywhere from 1 to potentially 3 rate hikes for the year. If U.S. growth continues to slow, I think that's going to, you know, bring down those expectations of no rate hikes this year from the Fed. And beyond that, even the Fed ending its balance sheet reduction. So those two things, no rate hike and a balance sheet reduction ending, I think could put a potential peak in the dollar, particularly if you compare growth differentials of the U.S. versus the rest of the world. The U.S. was kind of growing at a premium to a lot of other countries. If that premium shrinks because we're slowing and now they're accelerating, that could put a peak in the dollar, which would be beneficial for commodities, beneficial for international currencies, international equities, kind of really the opposite of what happened last year, where it was pretty much a U.S.-dominated market until the very end of the year when everything fell. So I think it could be a potentially an opposite year of what we saw last year.
Is that being reflected in international equities? Because if you look at some of the ETFs like EFA and EEM, which is emerging markets, these have really taken off since the beginning of the year. So how much, I guess, is already reflected in the price of these ETFs?
I think, you know, at least initially we are seeing some signs of stabilization there. I think the equity markets internationally are discounting a bottom in international growth or global growth. If you looked at the international equities, if you looked at emerging market equities, they didn't follow the U.S. and show the same type of damage that we saw in late November and into December. And many of them in several countries actually did not hit new lows in December from their prior October-November lows. So they were already kind of bucking the trend and moving to their own tune than what we were seeing here in the U.S. And I think that is their markets beginning to discount that there's light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the growth slowdown, that they're kind of seeing we're near the tail endings of this. The concern for me is, you know, the question is going to be, if we are going to see stabilization in global growth, the question really that's going to dictate a lot of future returns is, well, what kind of acceleration are we going to see? And that's kind of one of the problems that, or one of the things I'm thinking about, is every growth slowdown that we see, the acceleration out of that slowdown is getting weaker and weaker. I remember Fitch put out a report analyzing the stimulus that China did in 2016 to get us out of that last growth slowdown. And they said, you know, there's going to be a price to pay for that stimulus in terms of, you know, having even more debt. And, you know, essentially that was kind of what we saw over the last 2 years, is that now China's decelerating again, and yet they have even more debt than they did coming out of the last slowdown. And I think we're going to continue to see that, where economies are getting less bang for buck, whether it's coming from monetary or fiscal stimulus. And the concern I would have is, or at least my guess and theory is going to be, that the acceleration coming out of this next slowdown that we are probably within, you know, visible distance of globally, we may not have a robust recovery. And if we see equity assets rally strongly, anticipate we're going to get a strong recovery. You know, that's the thing where investors need to be cautious that they're not overpaying for overhyped growth.
I want to come back to the U.S. for a minute. We had Chairman Powell on Capitol Hill this week testifying, pretty much saying the same thing he did in January when the Fed did a 180. They're going to be patient and implying a pause. But I also want to talk about some of these indicators. You think we're slowing down, we're probably later to the game, and so our slowdown's begun. I noticed that the U.S. recession indicator, which was at 10 last August, is now 20 in the latest report released in December. So we've doubled. So let's talk about the implications for that and what this might mean for the Treasury market if the Fed goes on pause. And moreover, what if the Fed basically ends its quantitative tightening? What would this do to the Treasury market?
You know, there's a lot of cross currents going on. And so that one, to me, I don't think is clear cut. You know, last year, whenever we see U.S. growth begin to kind of pull away from the rest of the world, typically we see the U.S. dollar strengthen. We also see the U.S. bond market strengthen, the Treasury market and yields go down as the rest of the world kind of flocks to our higher yields and stronger economy. But we didn't see that. And a big reason for that was that the Fed was not only raising interest rates, which you see that on the short end, but on the long end, the Fed was reducing its balance sheet at the same time, which decreases demand. And at the same time, you had the Treasury doing a massive issuance of debt to finance the tax program that Trump had. And so you had this, you know, decrease in demand and increase in supply, which is putting pressure on yields when from the macro picture, otherwise, you know, normally you would have expected yields to fall with the slowing global economy. Looking at this year, that could also really change things where if the Fed is done shrinking its balance sheet, that's going to put less strengthening demand for treasuries in terms of the total picture as the Fed is not going to be as much of a seller of treasuries and stepping away from the treasury market. But, you know, at the same time, the one thing we have to kind of look at is, you know, nothing should be looked at in a vacuum. And so we have to really look at what happens in Europe, what happens in Asia, particularly Japan. Our interest rates and our growth cannot get too far away from the rest of everyone else where you start to see some arbitrage. That's kind of what I'm wondering about for treasuries this year is really watching German and Japanese yields. If we start to see those pick up because the ECB isn't done with their QE program and Japan has continued to decelerate their annual growth of their balance sheet with their program as well, if we see a pickup in foreign interest rates, that could put pressure on U.S. rates as well. So there's a lot of cross currents, and a lot of times you just kind of have to listen to the message of the market to see which force is the greatest. But I really think no one can have a really strong opinion because there's so many cross currents in terms of interest rates and bonds. But, you know, at least one feather in the bond bull camp is that the Fed is likely to end shrinking its balance sheet, which will definitely take some of the pressure off of long-term interest rates.
Well, let me turn to another sector of the interest rates, and that's corporate bonds. We're going to do it on the big picture. We're going to cover the OECD report, which is a little somewhat alarming, Chris, in terms of the amount of non-investment grade debt that's been issued and also the weakening of covenants on those bonds. And also if that with so much triple B sitting in these investment funds and ETFs, if the economy was to slow down, as we mentioned, the recession indicators doubled from 10 to 20 since last August. What about the corporate bond market and contrast that to treasuries?
You know, for there, I think there's still a lot of risk, mainly because I am seeing some signs of aging in terms of the U.S. business cycle. One of the things that I've been noticing as a trend of late over the last 1 to 2 months is that continuing claims in the U.S. are beginning to stabilize. And we could quite possibly have seen the bottom in initial jobless claims and continuing claims. If we start to see those gradually rise, that's going to be a warning sign that the U.S. economy is starting to slip here. And you typically see that as you approach a recession, usually with an advance. Usually the year-over-year rate of change in continuing claims turns positive months before a recession hits. So, you know, we were decelerating, I think, seeing claims fall by, you know, an annual growth rate of negative 10% or so. And I think we're now down to about negative 6 or so. If that keeps approaching the zero negative growth or flat growth and potentially turns positive, that would be a warning sign. And if we do see the U.S. economy continue to slip and potentially go into recession by next year, that would definitely put a lot of pressure on corporations as their revenues fall. At the same time, they're having to face a wave of corporate maturities of their debt and have to issue new debt to retire the old debt at higher interest rates because of credit risk. So that is definitely something to keep an eye on. This far, this late in the cycle, I think you have to stick with quality. And that means on your bond portfolios going towards less credit risk, like treasuries, and really focusing on risk.
You know, I want to contrast something. If you would have looked at the fundamentals last year, we had a $1.5 trillion tax bill go into place. You had corporate tax rates cut from 35 to 22 or 21. You also had a pickup in economic growth. So if you looked at it fundamentally, Chris, you would have thought, and plus corporate earnings coming in at almost 25% every single quarter. If you would have looked at that from a fundamental point of view, you would have never thought we would have ended up the year as we did with negative returns for stocks, bonds, and commodities. If you look at what's going on this year, the fundamentals are slowing down. The recession index has doubled. The ISM numbers, they're all rolling over, slowing down. So if you look at the fundamentals, you would say caution. However, if you look at the technicals look great and they say jump in. What do you do?
You know, I think you have to look for value. You know, you kind of have to have that margin of safety. And with so many stocks beaten up to the tune of 60, 70, even 80%, there's a lot of companies that are seeing their dividend yields because of those declines go from 2 to even 4%. I think you have to stick with value and a margin of safety. You look at the general stock market, we're pretty, you know, not too far off from those highs last year. We've had a tremendous run as if our fourth quarter didn't even happen. And, you know, you look at where we are right now, we're more or less where we were in October and November. And at that point, we had the U.S. economy was still near its growth peak, and we weren't even seeing signs of deceleration to sour the mood. And if you look at where we are now, we're seeing clear signs of deceleration in the U.S. economy. So the stock market is where it was, you know, 3 months ago, 4 months ago. But the fundamental picture has gotten worse. If you look at retail sales, auto sales, if you look at the housing market, existing sales or new home sales, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. And based on that, I think the market's gotten ahead of itself. And I wouldn't, you know, just buy the market blindly in terms of a passive approach. I think you have to get selective and look for value. And there's a lot of pockets of value out there. And as I mentioned previously, I do think that global growth should see a bottom in the first half of this year. I think the first quarter is going to be about stabilization. And I think maybe the second quarter might see the first signs of the, you know, the beginning of a reacceleration in growth. So I think, you know, there's some better value prospects and internationally, and that's also where you should be seeing growth picking up versus slowing down. So I think you need to stick with value. And I think just buying the U.S. indices at these levels with really a lack of value and a worsening fundamental picture than where you were 3-4 months ago, I definitely think there's a lot of caution to be had there.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this year plays. As again, 2018, the fundamentals were never better. Stronger economic growth, stronger earnings, and we ended up on the negative side. And this year, the fundamentals are deteriorating while the technicals at least look good. Chris, thanks so much for being on the program. If our listeners would like to contact you, how could they do so, please?
They can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can call me at 888-486-3939.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up in hour two, the big picture, Jim and I discuss what's happening with key commodities such as oil and precious metals. And also, we'll talk about the possible crisis in the corporate debt markets. We've done several shows on this subject, but it's now starting to gain wider attention. In fact, just this last week, the OECD issued an extensive report that we'll talk about coming up in the big picture.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.